Welcome to the Cultural Frontline on the BBC World Service. This is the program where all sorts of artists talk about how their work reflects and challenges what's happening around them. Cool, right? I'm Saha Zan, standing in for Tina Dahili on this week's show. I'm a reporter and presenter on the BBC World Service, and I'm very excited to share with you some unusual and powerful stories from four different corners of the globe. Ever wondered how a couple of spray cans with a touch of imagination can help the world become a better place? Well, I meet with one of UK's leading street artists to find out how she does it.
It is a new thing to see women doing this stuff. If it had been an easy ride, maybe my skills wouldn't be as good as what they are becoming now.
And remember that heartbreaking video of ISIS smashing parts of our history into tiny pieces? Well, I'm speaking to Ma'moun Abdul Karim, the man on a mission to protect Syria's historical artifacts.
We transported all the collection damaged by ISIS to Damascus. In September, we will start the program of restoration of the statues.
Also this week, how outfits associated with the Taliban are turning heads on the European catwalks. And a peculiar letter from Kuwait. One that reminds me a lot of Alice in Wonderland.
My face burned with guilt, as though my fictional words, written 4 years ago and still unpublished, had magically made this terrible thing come to pass.
Intrigued? Good. Sit tight, as you're in for a total treat on this week's Cultural Frontline. Just like deleting unwanted documents from your computer, invaders seem to have had a similar approach throughout history. Except that instead of pressing a button, they wrecked entire cities into rubble, burned handwritten books, and even smashed the pots our ancestors ate from. Basically, trying to destroy anything that could ever remind the natives of their heritage and history. This week was a special one for all of us whose hearts break with every historic artifact that gets destroyed. For the first time ever, a war crimes case was brought to the International Criminal Court for the destruction of culture. The case related to the decimation of historic shrines in Mali's Timbuktu in 2012 by a member of an Islamist extremist group. This is an encouraging step, and nowhere is this fight more needed now than in Syria. The violence at the historic city of Palmyra has been one of the most attention-grabbing actions of the so-called Islamic State during Syria's civil war. Priceless buildings and artifacts, including the 2,000-year-old Palmyra Arch, were destroyed on film. But Syria's archaeologists won't go down without a fight, as Director General of Antiquities and Museums, Ma'moun Abdul Karim, is the man leading efforts to preserve what remains of Syria's heritage. So, is he encouraged by this case?
I think this decision was very good news for us. We need this movement. We are encouraged that the international community can do something positive.
Do you actually think it would be a deterrent for the extremists?
For me, it's symbolic. We need to give message to terrorists. When you destroy the cultural heritage in any way, you will be condemned in this court in the future. It's like any crimes in the world. In the future, we will have a lot of the positive impact, anti-destruction, anti-crime, anti-our cultural heritage in the world.
Do you think this is enough?
No, it's not enough. We need also to control the black market. Our heritage, it's not destroyed by just terrorists, by ideological reason. It is the responsibility of each country to control the black market, how we can stop the trafficking. It's not battle for the politics. It's cultural heritage battle.
I want to talk about you and your team a bit more. I'm very interested to find out how you and your team have combated the destruction that is happening in Syria. What have you done?
Since 4 years ago, when we started to work, we started by closing of the museums. We hid all the collections. Then when the situation became very difficult, we transported all the collection to Damascus in general. We saved 99% of the collection in Syria. Fortunately, we do this work. And how we can work also for the cultural sites, because we have more 10,000 sites. For this reason, we addressed the people, if you save your country heritage, you will save honor of our mothers. We cannot divide this heritage into heritage, one for the government, another for the opposition. We have one heritage. It's our identity. It's our common identity. For me, I am optimist because I visit Palmyra after the liberation. We do it the assessment damage. More 80% of the Palmyra in safety. It's not damaged. It's good news.
I'm actually quite interested to find out why you think sites like Palmyra or Mosul in Iraq, why do you think they're so important?
All these sites present our common heritage. For me, Mali, Tombuctu is my heritage. Palmyra is my heritage. Mosul is my heritage. It's your heritage also. We have common heritage, but we have also common responsibility. How, as international community, we can save the heritage?
Do you think that culture and heritage can actually have a positive role to play in these times of war and violence?
For us, we are sure that crisis will finish. We are very sad for the life of our peoples. I know the life of the peoples is more important, but our work is archaeology, to save the cultural heritage, to give message to the people. When the war will finish, the people find that all the collection in safety, I am sure the generation in the future will be very happy. Of course, for me, it's reason behind my staying in Syria with my children through all tragedy, just to present new model how Syrian people can be together, how we can unite people, not divide people, through the new model of the work, how we can save our collective memory as Syrian people, as Syrian government and Syrian opposition, and also international community.
Ma'moun Abdolkarim, he's currently in the UK for Edinburgh's International Culture Summit, where this year the theme is culture, building resilient communities. After a two-hour train journey from London, I have arrived at a city in north of England mainly famous for two things: its football teams and rainy weather. Yes, Manchester. Surprisingly sunny Manchester, actually. I've come here specially to look for a certain girl with arms covered in tattoos, baggy jeans, short hair, and hands stained with spray paint. Her name is Joy, and she's a street artist. I first came across her work on the streets of London and was absolutely mesmerized by the surreal and dark beauty of her murals, transforming the appearance of our public spaces. Although she started spraying her thoughts illegally as graffiti, Joy is now one of the most in-demand street artists and actually gets paid to leave her mark across the country. What I love the most about her work is the fact that she tries to tackle some of the biggest social issues of our time through her rebellious street art. Now, where is she?
Hi, Joy.
Hey,
how's it going?
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
Well,
cool.
We're here.
Okay, it's just around the corner. It's not far, so.
Oh, wow. That's a lot taller and bigger than I expected.
We've come to the heart of the Northern Quarter in Manchester, which is like the Bohemian area, essentially. And this is a massive mural I painted.
I just really like the orange and the reds and the blues and everything you've brought together. What were you trying to communicate? I mean, what am I seeing? I'm looking at is that a dog? Is that a really angry, vicious-looking dog?
That's a really, really vicious-looking dog. And behind it, there is a young man, but you wouldn't know whether it's a man actually.
No.
Really, because the face is obscured with a cross, and that's to do with like ambiguity. So like,
doesn't even
like
have a face, it's just a cross, isn't it?
Yeah. Facelessness. And that's because this piece is about the suicide rates in the UK of young men under 40. It's actually the leading killer of young men under 40.
What? In the whole of UK?
In the whole of the UK.
What?
Yeah, it's the leading.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, in the whole of the UK. That's kind of why we slapped this big white cross across the face. There's a lot of like hidden like indicators. So the crown is meant to be like about the idea that, you know, in some ways it's a celebrated thing to be like a strong, tough guy. So the dog looks menacing, looks like it's going to rip your throat out. It's meant to be like the idea of all the repressed sort of feelings and, you know, but like unleashed. And we wanted to make it faceless so that anyone could really identify with this idea. There's a lot of issues with gangs in Manchester, and there's a lot of issues with young men joining gangs and trying to become like the Don, to be this like respected, you know, male figure. But tragically, most of them get involved in drugs, selling drugs, involved in knife crime.
Do you think the people who saw this mural, did they get the message that you were trying to communicate? Did they understand what you were trying to say?
Not completely. I think a lot of people were intrigued by it, though, and often it is that questioning that gets more people talking anyway. If you do something that's really, really blatant, sometimes it's just like, oh, right, that's about that, and no one talks about it. But this is kind of a bit open-ended, and you can't tell whether it's a celebration, you can't tell whether it's just a nothingness or whether it's a statement. So message-based work, I think, is more and more important nowadays, and it's a way of communicating to people or a way of getting people to talk about things that they wouldn't talk about otherwise. And I'd rather see that happening than another billboard for some product that I don't want to buy.
That's very cool. I cannot wait to see your other work. I mean, you promised you would take me to your studio, so let's go and have a look at the other work that you've done. And I also want to see you in action, because you promised.
Yeah,
let's
okay. Nomad Clan, which is myself and Hayley, goes under the guise of Alo. We are now probably one of the biggest recognised names in the UK street art scene. We are the first women in the UK that I know of that have been sponsored by a spray paint company, which is global. We've painted some of the biggest walls in the UK. We painted the first LGBT mural in the UK, definitely the biggest one. And Wide Walls, which is one of the globally biggest street art blogs out there, have said that we're like the UK's hottest talent at the moment. So that's really good. Really nice to hear something like that, because there's a lot of talent in the UK. You know, there really is.
Do you feel like, as a woman, did you have to work twice as hard to kind of prove yourself and be taken seriously?
Yeah, I still do. Genuinely.
But why do you think that is? Why do you think you have to work so hard to be noticed or be taken seriously in the street art?
I think there's a lot of holding back of female graph and street artists. Like Hayley talks about the story where she got put down like the other end of a paint jar. Oh, that's where you've come down, have you? The girls are all down there. Do you know what I mean? It's like, there's your corner, there's your little, you know, area. That's just like the tip of the iceberg of some of the stuff.
A couple of your work that I personally found quite striking, maybe it's because I'm from where I am or because the topic of Islam and hijab has been in the news recently. I've really noticed women in hijabs and women from different cultures that you put in your work, in your murals. Why is that? Because you are a girl from north of England and, you know.
Yeah.
How come?
Partly because I feel like we see plenty of white women in the media, but also because some of the topics that I'm painting about are quite specific. So the very first one that I did was in St. Paul's Cathedral, and they wanted me to do a painting of the Virgin Mary. So I decided that it would be a good idea to go and paint a Palestinian woman as the Virgin Mary, a refugee. It was just to show a different angle on something, and it just seemed like a really nice link to the fact that there's so many people fleeing Palestine, Syria. And right after I painted the piece, that very famous picture of the little boy washed up on the beach was released in the press probably about a week afterwards. And so someone built a shrine around the painting in St. Paul's, and people were going and praying in front of it. You know, so suddenly there's this massive spike of awareness from the papers.
So that we met, so this is actually a portrait of one of the guys. There's a lot of Sudanese in the refugee camp and a lot of...
What effect do you think your work is having? Obviously, you have a lot of ideas. You're trying to tackle a lot of different social issues. Do you actually think your work have any effect? Do you think they're tackling any of these problems?
I hope so. I get people being very moved. And St. Paul's thing, they released it as their official Christmas card for that year, which means it went out to the Queen and people like that. So it was on one of her many mantelpieces. And it's like, when people are moved by what you do, for me, that's when I feel, like, happy.
I just love this girl. Joy is genuinely one of the coolest girls I've ever met in my life. Take a look at her work on our webpage or social media and let me know what you think. You're listening to The Cultural Frontline with me, Saha Zand, and this is the programme that brings art and news together in one place. Now, imagine this. On a day like today, you decide to casually write down some of your craziest thoughts born out of your wildest dreams or even nightmares. Then the next day, you wake up and notice that the fiction you were writing has started seeping out into the real world. Like all those things that you were writing down, good or bad, are happening right before your eyes. Weird, right? Well, that's kind of what happened to our next guest, May Al-Nakib. She's a professor of comparative literature at Kuwait University and author of The Hidden Light of Objects, which is a collection of short stories. May is currently working on her first novel, and that is where the mystery began.
Oscar Wilde famously declared, "Life imitates art far more than art imitates life." One would assume that the art in question would have to be public to be imitated. However, a recent event in Kuwait eerily imitated art that only I and a few others know about. Life was imitating my novel in progress. I never discuss publicly the specifics of a work of fiction in progress. It strikes me as slightly damning, like slamming the door in advance on possible narrative trajectories or sealing characters' fates before their time. I'm making an exception here because I can't resist the lure of an odd coincidence. First, some background. The country had recently elected a conservative parliament, and one of the first things on its agenda was to draft an amendment making blasphemy a crime punishable by death. This new law was going to align Kuwait, known historically for its comparatively liberal press, politics, and social structures, with Pakistan and Saudi Arabia at the opposite end of the spectrum. The new parliament voted overwhelmingly in favor of the amendment. I was crushed. I wanted to hide under the covers and begin a 4-year period of hibernation until the next election. Instead, I started working on my first novel. That was in 2012. My novel in progress opens with the protagonist, a professor of philosophy at Kuwait University, being charged with blasphemy. If convicted, she will face the death penalty. Fortunately, in real life, after the yes vote by Parliament in 2012, potentially legalizing capital punishment for blasphemy, the amendment was dismissed by the Council of Ministers and so was not ultimately enacted into law. Today, blasphemy does not constitute a capital offense in Kuwait, though it remains a crime. In the imagined world of my novel, however, the 2012 law passes and my protagonist's life is on the line. Here's where things get strange. This March, a complaint by a Kuwaiti lawyer was filed with Kuwait's public prosecutor against a professor of philosophy at Kuwait University. The professor was being accused of blasphemy for comments she made during a television interview. When I heard about the recent accusation against my colleague, my face burned with guilt, as though my fictional words, written 4 years ago and still unpublished, had magically made this terrible thing come to pass. I'm not arrogant or superstitious enough to believe this to be true, but the coincidence troubled me nonetheless. Maybe it's not as odd or coincidental as it might appear. In my fiction, as a way to confront the upsetting turn my country seemed to be taking in 2012, I decided to experiment with the worst-case scenario. When ideas are criminalized and punishable, what else but terrible outcomes can transpire? There's no doubt that Kuwait enjoys more liberty than other countries in the region. But the fact that a random citizen believes he has the right to raise a case against another citizen for her political point of view points to a kink in the way some in my country conceive of freedom. Fiction gives writers a place to describe a small square of existence that matters to them. It gives readers the opportunity to inhabit that square for a time, to consider it, reject it, or use it to change their minds about preconceived beliefs. When I started my novel in 2012, and now, close to completing it 4 years later, the square that continues to consume me has to do with lost opportunities in my region. The criminalization of ideas shuts down both critical thinking and creativity. Without these, we lose the means to reimagine and reshape the world around us in ways that are, perhaps more ethical, more generous, more humane. Disheartening as things sometimes are regionally and globally, fiction writers refuse to give up this chance, as do some professors of philosophy. In real life, happily and rightly, the Kuwait University philosophy professor has been exonerated. This June, a judge dismissed the complaint against her, stating that not all discussions of religion constitute blasphemy, and that freedom of speech must be protected. For those of us who advocate, teach, or write about democratic and minority rights, freedom of speech and expression, and related concerns in Kuwait, this outcome was encouraging. This time, Kuwaiti law proved to be on the side of justice. I haven't decided whether art will imitate life in the case of my novel. My protagonist, the fictional philosophy professor, might not be as lucky. Where freedom and fiction are concerned, nothing is guaranteed.
That was May Al-Nakib. If there is one thing that really gets to me, is when I hear about any form of limitation put on freedom of speech and expression. Maybe because it takes me back to the frustration I felt growing up in Iran, where I was constantly hushed from an early age. Pale blue burqas, war after war, danger, and of course, the Taliban. Unfortunately, these are the things that immediately come to my mind when I first think of Afghanistan. Yes, I know there is a lot more, but what we constantly see and hear on the news has left a rather negative mark on my mind. That's exactly why our next guest has made it his mission to show his native Afghanistan in a completely new light. How? Through fashion. Yes, fashion. With his curly asymmetric hair, lip piercing and stylish outfit, the handsome 23-year-old Nawid Elias is a fashion designer like no other. Nawid comes from southeast of Afghanistan, one of the most dangerous parts of the world, and he's very keen to reclaim what he believes the Taliban have stolen away from his people. The iconic turban, shawl and shalwar are all parts of the outfit often associated with the Taliban. And guess what? Nawid absolutely hates that, because for centuries, this outfit has been a part of his ancestors' rich culture. So, he combines the latest Western fashion with the traditional Pashtun outfit to create a signature style that may have been born in one of the most dangerous parts of the world, but is now turning heads on the European catwalks.
Anyone can make clothes. What I try to do in my designs is to create outfits to tell a story that would get people thinking. I was in my early teens when I left Afghanistan. I was more concerned with integrating with the society in the Netherlands. So I had sort of forgotten all about Afghanistan. However, in the past few years, I became more and more intrigued with the culture of Afghanistan. Each of my collections tell a story, and I often try to combine the Pashtun and European high fashion together. I also tried to touch upon many things that may be considered a taboo back in Afghanistan. For example, in one of my early collections, I designed an androgynous wedding outfit for a gay marriage, or in my more recent collection called No Religion, showcased at this year's Paris Fashion Week, I explored religion. I have noticed that people often tend to be at war because of religion, so I combined three religions, Islam, Christianity, and Judaism, and made some of my male models wear headscarves and veils. This would obviously not be accepted in Afghanistan, but I got very good reviews from people in Europe, and they seemed impressed that someone who comes from a background of war and extremism has such liberal mentality. There were also some Afghans who showed some support, but mainly I got a lot of criticism from them, saying that it is shameful for an Afghan to do this. But it doesn't bother me. People are different, and some people may like my work and some people may not. A lot of them accused me of being gay, which is still a huge taboo in Afghanistan, or that I'm promoting homosexuality. I even received threats. I want to feel that I have freedom of expression and make things that gets people thinking and talking. I don't care for the lack of support or all the criticism, or even the threats I get don't bother me. People are free to do what they want, and I respect their choice. People in Europe often have a very negative view towards Afghanistan, and I try to expose the rich culture of Afghanistan and show who we really are. I try to show the beauty, culture, and history of Afghanistan. It upsets me that there are so many great talents in Afghanistan who can make much better designs than me, but they are deprived of facilities and people are drowning under the weight of their problems. I have actually heard that from many Afghans, accusing me of promoting for the Taliban. I think it is important for Afghans to read and learn about their own culture and history. The outfits that the Taliban wear actually belong to our ancestors in the region for thousands of years. I want to show that Pashtuns are not all Taliban. We are, in fact, very proud people and have a very unique culture with great traditions. That's my main aim. But I cannot stop what people think.
Navid Elias. I just couldn't help but smile when he was talking about exposing the world to all the wonderful things that his country, Afghanistan, has to offer. As a treat for you, we have made a picture gallery of Navid's bold and brave designs on our website. That's all from me this week. Tina will be back with you next time. Goodbye.